I thought what I'd do is skip the next noble one. And you wouldn't notice probably if I hadn't said it.
Which one
was? We get back to it maybe next week. But what we should be talking about next is right action. It's right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And I thought today that what I'd like to talk about today is right livelihood. And I think always, I think it's important to remember that the Eightfold Path is in the context of the Four Noble Truths, which is the spiritual context that Buddhism offers for its spiritual practice. And that it's not an ethical system. It's not, you know, right against wrong so much as it is. These are really important areas to investigate, to explore in a person's life. If you're interested in spiritualizing, in making your life happier, or making it less suffering, or more awakened, it's very important to look at these areas and understand them well and bring mindfulness to them. And so livelihood is one of those things. And I've wanted to, for some time, give a talk on livelihood and work for our community, because I feel that there's a tremendous amount of suffering in our community, not necessarily right here, but in the wider community here in the peninsula, around work and employment and finding work. And when I talk to people, it seems like one of the great sources of stress and suffering is work. And one of the things that Buddhists like to do is address or sit in the midst of suffering directly. I was very touched some years ago by something Usulananda said. Usulananda is a Burmese monk, Vipassana teacher, who now lives in Half Moon Bay. And he is a wonderful teacher. And he also he's also a teacher for the Burmese community. And in 1990, I was at a conference to talk about Buddhist ethics. And he was asked, what are some of the difficulties, ethical difficulties that you have in your community? The question wasn't exactly like that, but they weren't asking him, you know, for the gossip. But what are some of the dilemmas that they are faced with, some of the issues that were difficult for them, or for him as a teacher? And what he said was that he's kind of like a priest, a monk, for a lot of the Burmese community here in this area. And when they come to him, they ask him sometimes, is what I'm doing right livelihood? Is this my work, my employment, suitable thing for a Buddhist who wants to be freer and happier and create less harm in the world? Is it suitable for such a person, this kind of work? Is it right livelihood? And his dilemma is that he doesn't know how to answer them, how to respond to some people. Because he says a lot of the Burmese who come over here, they're immigrants. It's hard for them to find work. They have families to take care of. And if they finally find work, it's really great. And the alternative of not having work is a lot of trouble. However, some of them end up working for the weapons industry, for the military technology companies that might be in this area. And according to his understanding of Buddhism, is it's wrong livelihood to be engaged in anything to do with weapons and weapons production, weapons sales. And his ethical dilemma that he finds himself in, he doesn't know how to respond to them. Because he knows, you know, according to Buddhism, what's the right answer. But according to the human situation of these people having trouble finding work and having work and having a family to take care of, he doesn't want to say that to them. Because that's just going to make their life very, very difficult. And you know, if he tells them it's wrong livelihood and they keep the job because they feel like they need to, then it's then they feel bad, maybe more than they need to. And if he tells, and if they give that job up and they can't find something, that creates a lot of suffering too. And he just said it that way. He didn't, you know, say that he had a solution to it, or he didn't explain what he ended up saying to people. But he said this is a problem that he has. So right livelihood. And I'm very touched by many people, by Usulananda, by many students, practitioners, by people who, in a somewhat, the word coming to my mind is humble, perhaps, or simple way, trying to live more harmlessly, trying to live more honestly, and with more loving kindness and generosity, and trying to explore how to do that in their life. It kind of makes me just really happy, and I feel awe sometimes just to feel the many people in our community who are trying to live a life of more ethical integrity. So right livelihood. The word, I think, is something like ajiva, samma ajiva. And it really means right way of living, as I understand it. Livelihood implies, in my mind at least, it implies a career or work or employment. And the Buddhist term doesn't necessarily just mean limited just to that. It means the way in which you live your life. And so some people live their life, you know, that are occupied and engaged in life without, being gainfully employed, without earning a living, without making money. And it's a wonderful occupation. It's a wonderful activity to be engaged in. Sometimes undervalued in our culture. Housekeepers, for example. Mothers, traditionally. Fathers, being a full-time father. You can kind of say I'm a full-time mother, and people won't raise too many eyebrows. More now than they did 20 years ago. You what? But especially around here. But if you say you're a full-time father in this culture around here, eyebrows go up a little bit higher, a little bit quicker, don't they? But those are also, these are considered ways of living that can be wonderful ways of living. Being a monk, monks don't have any way of making a living, but somehow they get by. So anyway, we usually translate into English as right livelihood, but when we talk about it, we should understand that it's not limited just to, to work. And then in thinking about right livelihood, I think it's useful, again, as we talked about some weeks ago, looking at this core teaching the Buddha gave. When he was asked, what is the core teachings of Buddhism? And he said, to avoid evil, to do all good, and to purify the mind. And if we look at from those three standpoints, we look at livelihood, how to live our life, then Buddhism has teachings on all three, and all three are important, I think, to look at as a way of helping us to kind of reflect deeply about what's going on. So to avoid all evil. So then, in talking about the right livelihood, the Buddhist tradition then lists things that you should not be engaged in. Even though I said it's not an ethical system, there are certain things that come down pretty strongly saying, you know, these things are really inappropriate to be engaged in if you want to try to wake up, if you want to be live a life that's honest, harmless, without treachery and deceit. You should avoid these kinds of things. So one of them is... anything to do with weapons, sales of weapons, manufacturing of weapons. The other is, I guess, I don't know how to translate it or what it's exactly, but businesses that involve the sale of human beings. And, traditionally it meant slavery and prostitution, considered to be wrong professions to be in. I don't think Buddhism didn't criticize. Prostitution isn't considered by Buddhism to be a wrong occupation. But pimping is. Being engaged in that business of kind of moving people around and, you know, being kind of a middleman or whatever. There's a beautiful story of the Buddha coming to his town and. Just like in Japan, I guess, they have a whole gradation of different kinds of women engaged in what nowadays just called prostitution. But back then there was called many different words. And some of them were considered to be very honorable. And there was one woman, I guess we call it courtesans. And the Buddha came to the area, and she went out and invited the Buddha and his monks to come and have a meal. And he agreed, and at her house. And then a little bit later, all these dandies from town, all these young kind of aristocratic kids, showed up with all their finery. And it's quite dramatic, the imagery of they're all these guys, they have makeup on and wearing all their finest clothes, and they're described like dandies, you know. Show up and they come and they cross paths with the courtesan, and they say, you know, we're on our way to the Buddha to invite him to a meal. And she said, oh, I already invited him. And he agreed. And they say, and they go, oh shoot, we've been hoodwinked or something. We've been beat to it by the courtesan. Anyway, I'm sorry. This is just a tangential story.
There's no great meaning in that.
The only meaning was that I wanted to kind of backtrack from saying first before that prostitution in and of itself might be, by Buddhism, is considered to be wrong livelihood. You know, Buddhism doesn't come down that strongly against prostitution, but it does against the business, you know, of, you know, pimping or.
That's
probably a wider category than what's meant right here in terms of, you know, dealing with human beings. But certainly, I mean, you've seen in Thailand tremendous exploitation dealing with human beings, selling these young girls, you know, young boys, young girls who are not even teens, selling them to prostitution business in Bangkok. And those people who are involved in that kind of business and transactions, that's considered to be, you know, wrong profession, wrong livelihood, categorically. There's no question about it. So dealing weapons, dealing in human beings, dealing with, sometimes it's translated into English as flesh, dealing with meat, with the production of meat for consumption. So raising, you know, pigs and cattle and killing them and selling the meat. In Buddhist traditions, are considered to be wrong livelihood. Now, we might have different opinions about that in our culture, but that just telling you this is how the tradition sees it. And so then Buddhists are a little bit in Asia, then are, you could say, sometimes a little bit hypocritical, because it's the Muslim in town who's the butcher. And so they all go and buy their meat from the Muslim, and he does all the work. But anyway, so that's three or four. The fourth is dealing with intoxicants and drugs and in alcohol. That's considered to be wrong livelihood. Having a liquor store is not considered appropriate. And the fifth is dealing with poisons, having to do with business that deals with poisons that can kill people. So these are kind of traditional lists. They're 2,500 years old, and if we extrapolate into our culture, and then we can ask questions like, what about paying taxes? When the government is involved with war and killing people, and our money goes to paying that, are we involved in some way? How are we involved? Our consumer culture is so complicated, interrelated, that I believe that there are issues about our behavior and our actions which probably didn't exist in the time of the Buddha. And so we have, it's much more complicated for us to sort out these kinds of questions. Yes?
Friends, Quakers, quite often hold a percentage of their taxes that they understand to be the percentage of our taxes used for weapons.
Right.
And they withhold them, and sometimes they're audited and there's trouble, and quite often there isn't. But it's very commonly done among Quaker people.
It's a really wonderful example. I've known some, Eiken Roshi does this also. He does a system where he withholds his taxes, And then he puts them in a escrow, puts them in, I don't know what it's called, puts them someplace with a promise that, that you know, I'm not keeping this for myself. This is available to the government as soon as you clean up your act. Sorry? What if we were all to do that? Yeah, what if we all to do that? What would happen? There's, can I kind of go off on a tangent again? There was a song in Italy. When I grew up, part of my upbringing was in Italy. And there was this popular song that came out in the late 60s. And it went something like, chi non lavora non fa l'amore. The one that doesn't work doesn't make love. Now, it was a kind of nice, catchy kind of tune. But what happened was that all these wives in Italy discovered they had some power. And after the song came out, the unemployment rate in Italy dropped dramatically. So what if we withheld our taxes? You know, enough of us. And these are very important questions, I feel. So, yes?
Historically, during the time of the Buddha, there were kings and there were armies. The kings raised armies. Presumably, they taxed. They taxed the populace to raise armies somehow. I mean, probably ingrained. I'm not sure, but, I mean, there is in the time of the Buddha historical precedent for all of this happening separate from the monastic sangha. Obviously, they weren't paying taxes, so they didn't make any money.
Yeah, I don't know enough about it. I mean, it was a little bit of an, a monarchy was a little bit all powerful. So they might have done taxes in the old days, but also they might have had a different understanding. This wasn't just taxes, you know, this belonged to the king. He was just taking what belonged to him. It was like a sharecropper, you know. You're a sharecropper and you get to keep percentage and the king gets his percentage. It's not a matter of taxation. I don't know. I don't know enough about it. There's a story, if I may, this is, again, tangent. It's not addressing your question. Is that okay? Just that there was a story of it's called the incident at Rohini. There was a river between the country that Buddha grew up in and the neighboring country. And they were arguing over water rights. Who was going to use this river? It was a drought or something, and there wasn't enough water for both sides of the river. So they started yelling and screaming, and finally they decided to go to war. And so the Buddha walked out into the middle of the battlefield before the war started, before the fighting started, and he asks them, what is more valuable, water or the blood of a warrior? And they all kind of look around and say, well, the blood of a warrior, of course. And are you willing to spill the blood of the warrior for sake of some water? And they all say, I guess that's pretty silly. And so they stopped the fighting. I don't know what happened to the water rights, but it's a nice story for kind of a model of engaged Buddhism. The Buddha wasn't someone who's passive. The image we have of him is someone who actually went into the middle of a battlefield to try to stop. So the extension of some of these ideas of wrong livelihood. What about the advertisement industry? You know, it's a whole range of things that advertisement is. I don't want to give a blanket statement about, you know, judgment about what it is, but some of the advertisement I would say could be called deceitful. And if you're lying or deceitful, public relations. What about that? You know, public relations. You know, some people who do public relations are really out to snooker the public, that's for sure. And sometimes they do great, wonderful work. It's appropriate work. Yes?
It seems like one of the huge categories of our time that is missing is environmental.
Yeah, I think so.
Maybe the number one.
So as some of us were, so the harm to the environment. In the time of the Buddha, the environment, I guess, wasn't such a big hot issue. It was kind of taken for granted. And there isn't a lot of examples of the Buddha being an environmentalist because there wasn't really a need to. But I think that in our time, the tragedy of the commons is that the commons is no longer big enough for all of us to do whatever we want to. And so now there's these major consequences to the way we live our life and the choices we make. And sometimes I feel quite sad. I live up above in Skyline, and sometimes I drive down here during the day, and there's an amount of smog you see in here. It's just phenomenal. And you come down here, and you kind of think once you're in it, you don't necessarily see it as well. You only see it if you try to see in the distance, and you don't see it. And here I am driving my car. It's kind of painful. So I feel my own life. I feel there's a certain amount of things I regret about the way I live my life, the choices I make in terms of the environment, in terms of my consumption of things. And it's kind of shifted over the decades how much I've been willing to consume and have and things like that. Maybe I'm just getting soft as I get older, or indulging more. But I was much stricter when I was younger. But there's a kind of a trade-off, and I try to reflect the best I can about what my needs are and what I'm trying to do in life, and with the damage that causes. So, if I don't have a car to get around, it's hard for me to go around and teach. And it's my livelihood mostly to go around and teach, and hopefully it's more beneficial for me to go around. There's a kind of a balance, a trade-off there, in a sense, between the benefits that maybe hopefully come from teaching with the damage that comes with having a car that gets me to where I'm going to teach. And so I feel that. And so part of, for me, being a human being is to sit in the crucible, to sit in the fault line of those, that kind of decision, that kind of the polarity between those two. And so part of that comes with a certain amount of regret. And part of it comes feeling, well, if I'm not going to feel guilty, I mean, if I made the decision, hopefully it's a responsible decision. But still, I know that there's some damage.
We're all
hit, yeah. So some of us were told this weekend that some Buddhist monastics, there's nothing in the Buddhist precepts, ancient Buddhist precepts, 227 precepts for a monk or a nun, to say that they can't drive a car. And however, a lot of monastics don't drive cars. And apparently the reason is that you inadvertently kill a lot of insects and animals and stuff driving your car. It's kind of hard to avoid it if you can drive a car. And they don't want to be involved in that. And then it was pointed out, yeah, but they're willing to get rides. They're quite happy to let other people drive them around. So that seems a little bit funny. But be as it may, it's still the concern that's behind that decision is a beautiful concern. The concern of how to live a life that reduces harm to others and to the world around us. And with all these things, I don't feel like there's easy answers or any answers. But what I feel is really beautiful is to sustain the questioning, even though there's no appropriate answer. To stay there and have those, and to know there's people thinking about that and making some choices, hopefully choices based on that. But willing to stay there in the difficulty and the problem and thinking about it and reflecting on it. And who knows? If we do that for some time. Who knows what fruits that'll bring? Who knows how that'll finally flower into some new understanding or new decisions or new choices? So to do no evil, and there's to do all good. So the other side of right livelihood, to do good, And that means many things, you know, but I think to start off with, I like to think of it means to do some kind of work that brings you joy, to do some kind of livelihood that somehow brings enjoyment, has some joy in the activity itself. When I was growing up, my father used to tell me that if you don't enjoy your work, it's very hard to be helpful to anybody else. But if you enjoy, regardless of what you're doing, if you really enjoy your work, that in itself is helpful for the rest of the world. You know, if you're, if you're an artist or a pianist or something, and you really love that kind of work, you're not out there in the hospital or not out there, you know, and doing social work. You know, the classic ideas we have of what it is to do good. But if that's what your person really enjoys, I think that's the foundation of somehow helping each other. That's at least what I think. To do the positive, to do good. Then the last inquiring mind. You see in the back page, there was a quote by Robert Thurman, and he says, "Practice, practice, practice. That's all these Buddhists ever talk about. What I want to know is when is the performance." So the performance. So the performance should bring joy, which means identifying, finding out what it is that we find enjoyable. And I thought in this light, it's kind of interesting that the Buddha listed four kinds of joys that someone can have when they work and when they're kind of work from their work, I guess. The first is the joy of economic security acquired lawfully. And that's something that can make a person feel happy, and it's considered a wonderful kind of source of happiness, just to feel he has some economic security. Then there's a joy of wealth. So imagine you can be happy about having wealth, you know. And there's a kind of feeling in our culture that kind of has ambivalent feelings about wealth. A lot of people want it, but no one else wants you to have it. And then you feel guilty for having it, and so wealth is dirty and all these kinds of things. But at least the Buddha said there's a joy of having money, having possessions, having some wealth acquired lawfully, which is very tricky once you've read Marx, what that means. But the joy of wealth is also considered to be the joy, the happiness that comes from the wise use of lawfully acquired wealth. You know, how to use it wisely. So livelihood is not just simply making a living and acquiring, you know, income, but it's also using it wisely in a way that benefits society and the world and ourselves in a healthy way. Then there's a joy of not being in debt. And that's phenomenal, the number of people in America who are in debt. If they wanted all the money back tomorrow, it'd be a crisis. Then there's a joy of being without blame. You find in Asia, in Southeast Asia, that a lot of people feel a lot of happiness, kind of rejoice in the fact that their ethical life has integrity to it, that there's no blame to their ethical actions and activities. So to have a livelihood that has no blame isn't just simply a neutral thing, but that can actually be a source of great joy and happiness in a person. And then I added a fifth one, because I thought this list wasn't complete enough. And the fifth one I thought was the joy of helping others. It can be part of what livelihood or living in the world can be about. And that can be a great source of joy, is this feeling joy of helping or supporting or encouraging or whatever other people. But I think this, the most important thing is that the joining of activity, of livelihood, of work, and satisfaction and joy, to find that. And there's two ways of doing that. One way is to find some kind of livelihood that a person that you really enjoy. And the other is to find some way to enjoy what you're doing. It's like the song from the 60s, right? About you can't be with the one you love the one you're with. if you can't love, if you can't do the work you love, love the work you do. And that comes then to the third kind of Buddhism in a nutshell. To avoid all evil, to do all good, and to purify the mind. And to purify the mind is really the first two are considered to just be commonsensical ways of living. And the third has to do with liberation, with the real spirituality, the spirituality of Buddhism. To become free, to become awakened, to become intimate with all things. And this is where we look at work not just simply as a way of bringing avoiding harm in the world, a way of getting, you know, lawfully and properly gaining a livelihood or living a life, not just simply an activity that brings us joy and happiness, because joy and happiness is not liberation. And that's a very important point that Buddhism wants to make. Buddhism encourage you to live a life that brings happiness and joy, but don't confuse that with liberation, with spirituality. So, and the challenge, I believe, of the Eightfold Path, the challenge of the Four Noble Truths, is when we apply it to livelihood. The challenge is how to live a life that expresses our deepest spiritual understandings, our deepest spiritual goals, in a sense, if we may use that word. And that requires a number of things. It requires, one, understanding what the point of our spiritual life is. Maybe each of us has a different point or a different way of understanding it. But understanding perhaps what Buddhist spirituality is about, what it really entails, to really understand it well, so to understand how this can be then applied to work. If the practice is to, for example, wake up, if that's a very important aspect of it, to be more attentive and aware, how much of the time at work do you spend with your attention drifting off aimlessly, your energy dropping, and you're looking at your clock, you know, is it 5 o'clock yet, and being impatient and bored? Or is it, instead of kind of letting the mind drift off into those kinds of states, can we bring a sense of practice to those situations so the mind doesn't drift off into lethargy or boredom or restlessness or resistance or frustration, but rather the mind moves towards being more awake, more present, so our energy is there for life itself. And I think that's a lot of what mindfulness is teaching us to do. The first time I got the first time I got a glimmer of this was my first time I was introduced to mindfulness practice. I was in Thailand, and I did a long retreat. Near the end of that retreat, the abbot invited a couple of us Westerners to go into Bangkok to a funeral he had to preside over. And so I went, and it was a funeral for some very wealthy Thai general or politician or something, and it was totally boring. It was a totally boring event. It was all in Thai. I couldn't understand anything. And I was kind of bored. And then I thought, wait a minute. For the last 10 weeks, I've been practicing mindfulness, paying attention. I have something I can do here. I'll just stop paying attention. Because the boredom is a reaction to what's going on around you, and you're living reactively. And you're kind of being led around by the nose by the situation around you. So it's better to take the situation in your own hand. And one way to do that is to practice mindfulness and wake up, not be blown around by the situation. So I noticed, oh, I can pay attention. Suddenly I wasn't bored anymore. It wasn't particularly interesting, the activity, but you know what was going on. It didn't make it more interesting, actually, in some ways, but I was no longer bored. I was, you know, it's very interesting to be alert and attentive and aware. So if awakening is an important part of spiritual practice, then how do we bring that to work? How do we notice when we're not awake, when we're not paying attention, when we're kind of lost from awareness? And what does it mean to discover how to be aware in a work environment, in a work situation? I brought with me an example. I thought that was very nice. This is a very nice book, by the way, on this subject. It's called Mindfulness and Meaningful Work, Explorations in Right Livelihood. And it's a whole book on the subject, so... At the heart of workday practice is the intention to be aware of and connect with whatever is happening inside and around us, as well as the determination to initiate change when appropriate. A wonderful example of this process is revealed in the following story told to me some years ago by a physician friend. I'd like to share it with you in the form of a story entitled Little Green Dots. My friend told me that in his as his practice grew busier and more demanding, he began to have minor transient symptoms that included increased neck and shoulder tension, fatigue, and irritability. Initially, the symptoms were benign, disappearing after a good night's rest or a relaxing weekend. But as his medical practice continued to grow, the symptoms became persistent, and much to his chagrin, he noticed he was becoming a chronic clock watcher. One day, while attending to his normal clinical duties, he had a revelation. He walked over to a secretary supply cabinet and pulled out a package of little green dots used for color-coding the files. He placed one on his watch and decided that, since he couldn't stop watching the clock, he'd use the dot as a visual cue that served as a reminder to center himself by taking one conscious breath and dropping his shoulders. The next day, he placed a dot on the wall clock, for he realized, if I'm not looking at the one on my wrist, I'm looking at the one on the wall. He continued this practice, and by the end of the week, had placed a green dot on each exam room door. A few weeks after initiating his workday practice, he said that, much to his surprise, he had stopped, breathed, and relaxed 100 times in a single day. This simple, persistent decision to be mindful had been transformative. He felt much better, and most importantly, his patients told him that he was much more like himself. For him, that was the icing on the cake. So the green dots is one way to remind ourselves to pay attention, and the persistent habit of doing that over and over again has great benefit. It's kind of become second habit after a while. So that's one aspect. We can talk a lot more about that, of how to spiritualize our work is to see, is to understand what the practice is and how that can really apply to the work situation itself. But there are other things that should be worth, maybe significant to talk about. And one is, one of the things that keeps us from really spiritualizing our work, seeing it as a spiritual practice, seeing it or changing it if it's inappropriate and finding some other kind of work that's more appropriate for us that brings us joy or is ethical. Or one of them is fear that keeps us from changing. We're afraid, insecurity, discomfort that comes from going off into the unknown. I mean, sometimes some people need to quit their job and find other work in order to really allow them their life to be infused or move in the direction of their spiritual practice. It's hard to know, I mean, from the outside when that decision is right. But I've known lots of people who come to the decision that what they were doing wasn't really where they wanted to be and put their energy. And they've quit what they've done and done something else. And it's often very difficult to transition, especially if we've internalized all these values about earning a certain amount of money and having a house and a station wagon and a dog and, you know, all the kind of things we need to have in order to be successful and, you know, look successful. There's an expression, not downsizing. That's what corporations do, right? But some people decide to do that for themselves.
Downshifting?
Downshifting. What? Just simplify. Anyway, as America downsizes, so should we, happily. Downsize some of our lives. And related to that, I think, is to have real needs. And I think there's a close relationship between our needs and our ability to choose livelihoods that are spiritually supportive. What are really our needs that we have? I was in a restaurant the other day and they had this huge color television. I'd never seen anything so big. And it's really beautiful, crystal clear, picture. And it was really fascinating to watch these people. They're bigger than life size. And it's just clarity. It was a really beautiful thing to watch. And what happened? I want one of those. Yeah, I've given that one up. Well, I'm talking too much. Simplify here. Should we take a couple of comments before we end? Judith?
Earlier, you were speaking about needing to do some things in your life that you don't entirely approve of. Perhaps supporting the media industry in some way, or especially around the environment, for driving cars, all these things that we're all participating in. And Native American people, when they take a life to eat it, they thank that being for giving itself so that their being may live.
Right.
And I have learned from this that gratitude is essential in this state, because we cannot live as purely as we want to. Therefore, we must be grateful for being allowed to make mistakes, almost, so that we may survive and live the way we want to. And there is a law of what Indian people call reciprocity. When you take something, you give something back in return. Even if you're out in the woods and you pick a flower, you don't just pick it and walk out of the woods. You leave something. It can be a little spit or a hair, or better if you have some sage or tobacco. But something must be returned.
That's nice.
For everything that we take in
this
life.
That's very nice.
And one of the things we can always do is be grateful. And I think that helps if, as you say, this beautiful increased awareness that you are trespassing or doing more than you should be, is the first step. The second step is to thank the powers that be that have given you what you have wanted and needed at that moment.
Oh, beautiful.
And that this helps to keep your spiritual life as clear as you can, I think.
I think it's beautiful. Yes.
This was something that came up when I was on the retreat with Joseph and Sharon, is that there doesn't seem to be any equivalent of gratitude. There's loving kindness, but there doesn't seem to be in the Buddhist tradition. I never read or hear anything about that word gratitude, which I find so important. Mm-hmm. Someone else raised the question, but I was stumbling in the same way of trying to find a little prayer to say before I ate. You can do metta, but that's not, if something's been killed in the past, because right. Whether it's plant or animal, something has died so you could live. How do you express your gratitude?
I think for me,
is there anything?
If someone wants that answer, yes?
Thich Nhat Hanh has a very nice offering of gratitude for food, light, the water that cleans it. It's really very nice.
It's on a little card that's available from Paradox Press. The whole
Zen tradition is one of gratitude. I mean, you're always bowing to everything.
Right.
Yeah, no, really, because you go to a Zen retreat, I mean.
Yeah. That's part of Buddhism in general.
Deference or gratitude?
No, it's actually gratitude. Isn't that even said, Gil? I forgot the services is gratitude.
I don't know, but I mean, bowing has always been a big part of what bowing has been an expression of gratitude, and I, in my own experience has been the more clear, more open, more mindful, and more awake I become, the stronger my sentiments of gratitude are. So it's natural then to want to express it, and it's nice to have channels for it. So it's nice to have a little chants. It's nice to have little rituals to express that. I found it very valuable lovely in my monastic practice, both in Zen and also in Southeast Asia, that there's a lot of bowing that goes on. And the bowing then is allowing me to express the gratitude that comes from the practice itself. And in the kind of environment that we are here, where we just kind of come together Monday evenings and sit and talk, we don't have these forms of bowing too much. I bow at the end of the evening a little bit, but that's certainly bowing is for me. It's more than just gratitude, but gratitude is one aspect of it. Yes.
It also seems to me that along with gratitude, there's responsibility, because there are going to be times when things will be killed, or we'll have to use our cars and do things that we may feel are not right to be doing. But I think if we can be responsible and manage those things, are stepping into that realm, so that that seems like a very important thing to think about.
I think one of the things that spirituality, probably of most traditions, is trying to overcome is egocentricity. And so another way of saying what you just said is that if we stop living egocentrically, then we start living in a life that's connected much more and feels connected to the world around us. And so then our decision making isn't just simply me and mine and what I'm going to get my own is what I deserve. But rather, we feel that, you know, that our decisions are for the whole situation, including ourselves, but for the whole situation. And so, like what Judith said about, you know, the if we start living egocentrically, I think we start feeling that there's a give and a take, and there's a sharing and offering back, and that happens. Last one, and we should go home.
I'd like to sort of hit on the sort of basic dichotomy of life and particularly of work. I've been very lucky in my work. I decided about a profession when I was 16 years old, and I pursued that profession. I've been fairly successful in it. I chose a profession that wasn't going to give me a whole lot of money. But it's a profession in which there is inherent lying, because I have been involved in the performing arts my entire life. And so every night I help a group of people stand up and generate what is probably one of the largest lies in existence.
It's a matter of definition.
But there's a truth in that lie, supposedly, but it's all... there's no yes or no. You know, there's really no black or white in this group, and particularly in that aspect. The other thing is that I work. The profession I've chosen demands of you. You know, people looking at the clock has never been a problem for me, because I've always got a day and a half's worth of stuff to do every day. And I have no compulsion about if I manage to get what I need to get done that day, about leaving a half hour early, because I know tomorrow I may be there 2.5 hours late. And, And for a great deal of my life, I wasn't compensated for that. I did it because it was what you would be done. And there are times when I thought, you know, not only is it rewarding and a very exciting and a whole lot of, it's been a very rewarding career for me, but it's also had moments of just absolute despair. You know, how am I going to get through this? I can't spend another 10 seconds here. And it's not the same minute to minute, hour to hour, day to day. It's not. And everything that we said tonight seems to lay down certainties, and there are no certainties in this.
That's hopefully what I wanted to say when we started. I tried to say when we started. Was what I think is beautiful is people who ask the questions and are willing to bring the mindfulness to this area to explore. And these lists of things you should and you shouldn't do are not so much guidelines of what you should and shouldn't do, but guides to help you become mindful in your own particular situation. That's my understanding. So I think we should probably go home so we're not too tired at work. Thank you.